The scripture reading this morning is taken from Ecclesiastes 3, verses 1 through 8. To everything there is a season, a time for every purpose under heaven, a time to be born and a time to die, a time to plant and a time to pluck what is planted, a time to kill and a time to heal, a time to break down and a time to build up, a time to weep and a time to laugh, a time to mourn and a time to dance, a time to cast away stones and a time to gather stones, a time to embrace and a time to refrain from embracing, a time to gain and a time to lose, a time to keep and a time to throw away, a time to tear and a time to sow, a time to keep peace and a time to speak, a time to love and a time to hate, a time of war and a time of peace.
It is so good to see each one of you here today. And I am so glad that you decided to come. To those who are visiting with us, I want to say again, welcome. To those of us who work and worship here, we hope you've received a warm welcome from us. We want you to come back at every opportunity that you have. As was mentioned earlier, our preacher is out of town, so they've called in a sub, and so I am subbing for him today. In the late 1950s, Peter Seeger, who is a folk singer, wrote a song that was popular in that day. Now, those of you who are older probably can recall the song, and it's called There Is a Sign, a Season, or it's also called by the title Turn, Turn, Turn. It's been recorded by top folk singers of the day, and Seeger will not get credit for being original with those words. Actually, 98% of the words of that song were written by Solomon close to 3,000 years ago, and it's best known from the passage that was read in your hearing a few moments ago in Ecclesiastes 3, verses 1 through 8. Now, these words, we're talking about these first eight verses of the chapter 3 of Ecclesiastes. These words have been frustrating scholars for years. Some have taken these words totally in a negative way. They say that the preacher Solomon is complaining in a negative way that God has so arranged things in the world so that man has absolutely no control over what happens to him. So everything is predestined or foreordained. God has set the seasons and the times, and I agree in the context. Solomon is speaking about the negativity, about the futility of life, but the Bible does not teach that God violates our free will that He's given to us, and that man has lost control of what happens to him. Now, there's another group of scholars who ignore the context and take those words in a totally positive way. They say that all that Solomon is saying is that they teach that there is a right time and an appropriate time for all things. And again, I believe there is an element of truth in that summation. What we can see in addition to that in chapter 3, verse 11, he has made everything beautiful in its time. Chapter 8, verses 5 and 6. He who keeps his command will experience nothing harmful. And a wise man's heart knows both time and judgment, because for every matter there is a time and judgment. Chapter 11, verse 9. Rejoice, O young man, in your youth, and let your heart cheer you in the days of your youth. Walk in the impulses of your heart, and as you see to the best. But know that for all these God will bring you into judgment. Now, this doesn't seem to be the main thing, I believe, that the preacher is emphasizing. The context is a negative one. Now, before these verses, Solomon says back up in chapter 2, verse 26, that all is vanity and the vexation of spirit. That's the summation there. Then he summarizes in the first eight verses of chapter 3, with verses 9 and 10, which we did not read. What profit has the worker from that which he has labored? I have seen the God-given task with which the sons of men are to be occupied. Now, in light of the truths in verses 1 through 8, there seems to be no profit in laboring, for everything man does ends up being undone. It looks like a sense of travail. It seems like a sense of mass confusion. Now, I have no objection to taking segments of the passage to note that there are appropriate times to embrace and there are appropriate times to refrain from embracing. There's a time to keep silent and there's a time to speak. There's a time to laugh and there's a time to mourn. I believe the thrust of the passage is this, though. Life is just frustrating. Life in general is frustrating. Life is not all good. Life is a mixture of good and bad. You see, in spring, it's followed by summer, then fall, then winter, then spring again. So over and over and over, there are seasons of life, whether you and I like it or not. There are going to be seasons of life. We have seasons of laughter, followed by a season of crying and tears. Everything is not lived on the mountaintop. There are valleys that we must live in. There are times when we are happy and we laugh and we say, man, this is good. I wish this happened more. And then all of a sudden, something happens and our heart breaks and we begin to cry. And there's tears, there's dread, there's sadness. Laughter is followed by tears, then laughter, and then tears again. And so there's a time of war and then there is a time of peace, which is followed by another time of war. And as Peter Seeger says in the song, the cycles of good and bad just seem to turn, turn, turn. Now then, you stop and think about it. Life is pretty frustrating. When you get something nailed down, the nail comes loose. Nothing stays done. You plant a flower. That flower is pretty. Then soon it dies. You dig it up, plant another. You build something, it doesn't last forever. You tear it down, you remodel, or you build again. You would think that when you get something that it's yours forever. Not so. You may lose it. Clothes do not stay repaired or new. They do wear thin. Beds do not stay made. Dishes do not stay clean. They get dirty. Floors do not stay clean. They get dirty. It would be easy for us to echo the sentiment of verse number 9 where Solomon says, what is the profit in what we do? As we would say, what's the use? My wife has a sign at the house which says, housework never killed anyone, but why take a chance? You see, clean door floors get dirty. Made beds do get unmade again. You wash the clothes and they get dirty. What's the use of bringing new life into this world knowing that it's going to die? The doctor may say, what is the use in helping people heal themselves? They're going to end up dying anyhow. In war, or by disease, domestic violence, foreign fields. The farmer says, why would I clear this land and plant this crop when a storm can come and then remove and destroy all of my efforts? Husbands and wives who are in love and have a wonderful life, somehow they let debris get into the relationship, and over time, love turns into resentment and then to hate, and then they're both devastated. And they say, what's the use? What's the use in being happy, knowing that in a moment something can happen? A phone call can turn that happiness into crying. Now you're filled with dread and remorse. Put that way, it seems pretty hopeless. Viewed from the two-dimensional standpoint, life doesn't seem to make sense. Seems like a bunch of contradictions. So my question today is there any way we can make sense out of all of this? Can we make sense of it? Solomon doesn't leave us with a pessimistic picture that he's painted there in verses 1 through 9. Solomon said it's a mystic picture that he's painted for us. Look at verse 1 again. To everything there is a season, a time for every purpose under heaven. And he follows this passage with the most meaningful words, I believe, in the book of Ecclesiastes. And that's verses 10 through 15. This is one of those rare occasions when the heavenly sunlight shines through this earthly gloom and all these apparent, seemingly, contradictions. In view of verses 10 through 15, he gives us at least four suggestions where he tells us how we can make sense of all of it. Now, you can write these down. You can put these in your take-home box and take it home. Here we go. Number one, verse 10. I have seen the God-given task with which the sons of men are to be occupied. Verses 1 through 9, we're told that these things keep happening over and over and over, but the name of God is not mentioned. But now we're told the hand of God is in everything that's happening, over and over and over. He said God's hand is in all of this. When you listen to the news on the TV or the radio, or you read about it in the newspaper, you may wonder who's running things. It seems like things are coming unglued. It seems like things are not staying nailed down. Things are falling apart morally and physically and spiritually and domestically and politically. Seems like everything's just falling apart. Who in the world is in control of all of this? I tell you, God is in the midst of all that's happening. The God-given task. Jeremiah 10, verse 7 says, who would not fear the king of all the nations? So there's value in this hard work of learning how to cope with all these problems of life. It's our God-given task. As things turn, the seasons of life just keep coming and turning. So God is in the midst of all that's going on with us. Look at the first part of verse 11. That's the second thing. He has made everything beautiful in its time, and he has put eternity in their hearts. Some translations have it appropriate, some have excellent or something similar. But the original Hebrew word means beautiful. He has made all things beautiful. How much is everything? Anybody know? Anybody know? How much is everything?
All of it.
He's made everything beautiful. Now then, if God's in the midst of all this, then it's going to make sense. Why? Because God is not nonsensical. All this refers back to all that's mentioned in verses 1 through 8. Not that all things are beautiful in and of themselves, but when they become a part of God's overall plan, they become beautiful, because we know that all things work together for good to those who love God, to those who are called according to His purpose. Romans 8, verse 28. Now that it's not all things are good, but God works them together to produce good. Think about a jigsaw puzzle. Had an aunt. She didn't have any children. Heard her husband's children were dogs and cats and birds. Had a little monkey one. I hated that monkey. That little old toy monkey would grab you. I hated that thing. That was their children. And so they didn't have to childproof their house. They had a big table, and they liked to work puzzles. And you'd go over there, and there'd be just a puzzle spread out all over the place. And she'd start the border, and you'd go by, and you'd spend 15, 20 minutes, put two or three pieces. That's okay, fine. And so when they'd finally finished the puzzle, she would frame it, and it was a beautiful picture. But when you open up that box, 500, 600, 800 pieces, they're ugly. They're distorted looking. They're cut different ways. It looks like a bunch of scrap. That's what it looks like to me. But pretty soon you start connecting those little individual pieces together, and all of a sudden it starts transforming before you. There then becomes that beautiful picture that's depicted on the front of that box. This is the way life is. All those things that are happening to us, those isolated pieces of the puzzle, all of these will be put together and made a pretty picture, a beautiful picture. And so our problem is we have trouble seeing the big picture. We have trouble seeing the total picture, the whole scheme of things, and that's what's very confusing. Why is this happening to me? And as we open our Bibles and study, and we come along and we find there is Job on the trash heap in Job 2 and verse 18, or verse 8. He has lost everything. What has he done to deserve all this? Then we're reading and we're studying. We see Joseph sold into slavery in Genesis 39, verse 28. And we wonder about all this. Then finally we see Daniel thrown into the lion's den in Daniel 16. Then we look at Jesus dying on the cruel cross of Calvary. And all four of the gospel writers give us the story. These isolated situations are very ugly. Jesus dying on the cross. Here is an innocent man being executed for something he didn't do, which turned, we think, being the worst thing that ever happened, but it turned out to be the best thing that ever happened for us as mankind. So part of our problem is we can't see the total picture. We can't see the big picture. Perhaps we're not looking for it. Perhaps we don't want to wait and let God finish the picture. There's a sign that some of us have seen. Maybe you have it in your home. Maybe you have it somewhere. Be patient with me. God is not through with me yet. God's still working on me to produce that beautiful, beautiful picture. We cannot know God's timetable. We're unable to figure it out. We cannot fathom the purpose and the times of God. And that's confusing to us. When I was a boy, there were people who said, is he ever going to grow up? There were others who said, is he ever going to amount to anything? And then there were some who said, is he ever going to settle down? Look at me now. I did grow up. I did settle down. And I've been preaching the gospel for over 40 years. But God's not through with me yet. All of this has gone in to make that picture. So this is the most depicted passage in the book of Ecclesiastes. Let me tell you what I think it means. In the Septuagint version of the Old Testament, the word translated eternity. So he has set eternity in their hearts. Now, is that not a beautiful thought? That God has set eternity in our hearts. That's a beautiful thought. We can never be completely and totally satisfied with earthly things because eternity is in our heart. But yet, so much of our time is consumed with things. We borrow money to buy things we don't need to keep up with people we don't even like. And it's stuff. One lady had this to say about stuff. Every spring I start stirring in my stuff. There's closet stuff and drawer stuff and attic stuff and basement stuff. And I separate the good stuff from the bad stuff. Then I stuff the good stuff back in the drawers and the closets and the basement. Then I stuff the bad stuff anywhere the stuff is not too crowded until I decide if I'll need the bad stuff. When the Lord calls me home, my children will both want the good stuff, but the bad stuff, stuffed wherever there is room among all the other stuff, will be stuffed in bags and taken to the dump where all the other people's stuff is. Whenever we have company, there's always bringing bags of stuff. And when I visit my son, he always moves his stuff so I'll have room for my stuff. My daughter-in-law always clears a drawer of her stuff so I'll have room for my stuff. Their stuff and my stuff. And I thought it would be so much easier to use their stuff, leave my stuff at home with all the rest of my other stuff. This spring, she said, I had an extra closet built so I could have place to put all my stuff. Too good to throw away and too bad to keep with all my good stuff. You may not have this problem, but I spend a lot of time on my stuff. Food stuff, cleaning stuff, medicine stuff, clothes stuff, outside stuff. What would life be like if I didn't have all my stuff? Now, there's stuff I use to make me smell better than I do, and there's stuff to make my hair look good, and stuff to cover up bad complexion, stuff to hold me in, stuff to fill me out. There's stuff to read, stuff to play with, stuff to entertain, stuff to eat, stuff ourselves with, all of the food stuff. The other day when our preacher mentioned something about finding some of his daughter's stuff when he moved, I thought, oh, how I'd hate to move my stuff. There's that stuff in the house, in the attic, in the basement, in the garage, in the patio. Well, our lives are just filled with stuff. Good stuff, bad stuff, little stuff, big stuff, useful stuff, junky stuff. Now, whenever we leave all of our stuff and go to heaven, whatever happened to our stuff won't matter. We'll still have all that good stuff God has prepared for us. Then I thought about us. And I look in the parking lot. And I look at the clothes we wear. I look at the jewelry we wear. I look at the hairstyles that we have. And here we are. We're trying to satisfy ourselves with stuff. When eternity is in our heart, and we'll never be satisfied with all that stuff. Look at the cars we buy. We always want the newest model. We want the newest fashion. Our homes, we update or we upgrade. Or we buy a new house. Or we build a new house. We want the latest thing available. Something new. Something better. Got to try the food at this restaurant. Let's go try that food. You heard about it? It just opened Saturday. Let's go try it out. We got to have the latest thing. The Amplified Bible has it this way. He's planted eternity in men's heart and mind. The Revised Standard Version says he's put eternity in man's mind. Only mankind has eternity in his heart. Our animals do not have eternity in their heart. Your cat, your dog, your goat, your cow, your horse, your whatever, your snake, your pig. It doesn't have eternity in its heart. You give it some water and some food. Maybe give it a toy and it's satisfied. Why? It doesn't have anything else to look forward to. But we look what we have to look forward to. Why? Because we have eternity in our hearts. If we could just get that in our minds. So you tie that together with the rest of the verse. The latter part of verse 11. So that man cannot find out the work that God maketh from the beginning to the end. You contrast that with he's made everything beautiful. And he's put eternity in our hearts. You contrast it with that. We'd like to know about the beginning to the end. Where did I come from? Where am I going? Why am I here? You cannot find out these things by yourselves. We have to have help. So God helps us through His Word, the truth. John 17:17. Therefore, eternity is in our hearts. So what should this make us realize? Our need for God, not things that perish with using. Now, number 3, verses 12 and 13. I know that nothing is better for man than, number one, to rejoice, number two, to do good in their lives, and also that men should, number three, eat and drink, and number four, enjoy the good of all of his labor. It is the gift of God. Several gifts that God has given to us, but every good gift and every perfect gift comes down from above. From the Father of lights, with whom there is no variation or shadow of turning. James chapter 1, verse 17. So I want you to look at what he's given us. This is how to make sense of all this stuff. Look at what he's given us. It's a gift. He's given us the capacity to rejoice. Did you know that that has been a gift God has given to you? You have the capacity to rejoice. You have the capacity to laugh. Y'all try it sometime. It's good for you. Some people are just packed too tight. I believe that Jesus was fun to be around. I don't think he went around with a long face and you never did hear him say anything that was funny. I got a sermon I'm going to preach sometime if I have the opportunity. The humor of Jesus. It's first century humor. And you miss it because you don't know what first century humor is like. Jesus was fun to be around. Are you happy? You say, yeah. Won't you let your face know it? It doesn't know it yet. Some of my brethren look like they're still airsick on their trip back from heaven. So we have this ability to rejoice. To laugh, to hug, to clap our hands, to smile. This is good. I like this. Express our joy. Number two, we have the capacity to do good. That's a gift. You have that capacity. God's given that to you. To do some good things, good deeds, help someone. Defend the defenseless. Be honest in your dealings with others. Make wise decisions. Tell the truth. Aid someone who is being bullied. Being courteous to the waiter or waitress in the restaurant. I've been in a restaurant so now, and I watch as they bring the menu. People are looking at the menu. The waitress or waiter comes over with a smile, and they try to be conversational, and they're sitting there just like a big old knot on a log. They won't even look at the waitress. Won't even look at the waiter. And you're expecting them to keep your coffee filled and your tea glass filled, bring you bread and butter and all that kind of stuff. And you won't even be nice to them. Shame on you. Be nice to somebody. Be courteous. Console the distressed person. I was in a store the other day that has shopping carts. And those people who put those shopping carts together out in the parking lot really jam them in there. Sometimes you get one that, I mean, you just got to jerk and pull. You can't get it apart. Here's this little old frail lady. She's trying to jerk. And they always got their pocketbook. So they got it hanging on and they got to control that. Hold that on their shoulder. And they're jerking on that thing. What would be wrong with going over and saying, ma'am, here's mine, take mine. I'll work on that thing for you. You go ahead. I've already got mine loose. But no, we let some little old lady just struggle and pull on that thing. We could be nice. So we have the capacity to enjoy the simple pleasures of life. That's a gift that God has given to us. Enjoy your favorite chair. A hot shower. A simple meal. A glass of tea. The antics of a child. Enjoy the song of the bird out in the backyard. Listen and enjoy the tone of voice in your spouse and hear the love that's there or your child. Listen to the tone. You have the capacity to enjoy the simple pleasures of life. And then finally, you enjoy the work that you do. The blessing of work. You got a job. You can do things with the skills that you've been given. You can be productive. Enjoy the work that you do. They say that 65% of the people in the working world will go to work tomorrow to a job they don't like. That's amazing. I hope it's not among you as God's children because you've got the gift. He's given you that gift to enjoy your work. You got a job, your truck will start. You don't have to be pushed off. So enjoy that. At the beginning of our lesson today, we stressed that bad follows good. Some view life that way, but is not the opposite also true? I want you to check the contrasts in verses 1 through 8. Half of them start with the negative first. Then about the other half, start with the positive first. Perhaps this is done deliberately by inspiration to impress upon us that not only does bad follow good, but good follow bad. And in verses 12 and 13, he's simply enumerated these simple pleasures. And so in the text, when our circumstances in life are the darkest, there are some things that we can enjoy. There are some things we can rejoice about. And Solomon's words are more impressive when you consider the context. And the main thrust of chapters 1, 2, and 3 is that happiness does not come through riches or stately living. It comes from the ability to enjoy life. The ability to enjoy it. Now then, you can eat and drink, enjoy the work that you do, the ability to rejoice, the ability to do good, the ability to encourage others and bring happiness to someone's life, a smile to their face, give them hope that they can say, I can do it another day. You have that ability to do that. Don't know about you, but I believe there's a lesson in this for me. I hope it is for you. You see, I need to enjoy life as it comes. We're too blessed to be depressed. The psalmist said, this is the day the Lord hath made. Now watch this. And we'll rejoice and be glad in it. He's not going to make us rejoice. He's given us the ability to do it. We've got to make up our minds. He's made the day for us. He said, now go out there and enjoy this day. Depend on me. I've made all things beautiful. I've got eternity put in your hearts. Therefore, you can't be satisfied with all this other stuff. The unpleasant, the pleasant, the discouraging, the discouraging, the unconcerned. I need to learn to take life as it comes. All these seasons of life, as it turns, 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 I need to learn that I need to see the big picture. That God is in all this, His hand stirs. And then finally, verses 14 and 15. I know that whatever God does, it shall be forever. Nothing shall be added to it, nothing taken from it. God does it. That men should fear before Him. That which is has already been, and what is to be has already been. But God requires an account of what is past. I need to learn to trust Him as life turns, turns, turns. Question. Got two questions, actually. The first one's easy. Do you believe in God? You say, why, yeah, preacher. The preponderance of the evidence tipped the scales in favor. I believe in God. Second one's a little harder. Do you believe Him? Do you believe Him? Do you believe what He says? Do you believe His promises? Do you believe Him? Life turns, turns, turns. We need to depend upon Him. He says, Steve, I'm going to keep turning it and turning it and turning it until you learn it. Until you learn to trust me on a daily basis. I'm not going to do anything to your detriment. Everything is going to ultimately turn out for good and to my glory. Trust me. Trust me. But yet there are a lot of things that we don't deal with. It's stuff we don't deal with. We let family ties slip. In Ephesians 6 and verse 4, fathers, provoke not your children to wrath, but rather bring them up in the nurture and the admonition of the Lord. We let family time slip. We need to deal with it. We need to work on our anger. Ephesians 4 verse 26, be ye angry and sin not. Some of us are worry warts. Jesus said, which of you by worrying can add a cubit, or that is 18 inches, to your stature? If it's too small to pray about, it's too small to worry about. There are issues with family members that we need to take into consideration. Find a solution. But then there's the sin problem. We keep putting it off. We take care of everything that needs to be taken care of in our physical lives, and we delay this. Two boys walked up to a priest and asked him this question. When's the best time in a man's life to repent? He said, boys, the last day of your life. He said, we don't know when that's going to be. He said, then do it now. Do it now. Is not that the sentiment of Paul in 2 Corinthians 6 and verse 2? Behold, now is the accepted time. Behold, now is the day of salvation. Now, today, knowing what you know. Why? Why have you waited so long? Knowing what you know. Why would you wait any longer? Do you believe Him? Do you have the courage of conviction as a believer? Turn from all your sin. Confess what you believe about the deed of Christ. That is, He's the Son of God. Die to self-rule, self-will, and be buried with your Lord by baptism into death, raised to walk in newness of life. Let Him add you to the church. Give your new name Christian. Wear that name proudly. Be faithful unto death. Today, would you be willing to do that? The Lord invites you to do that. He invites you to come. Then He waits to see what you'll do. I'll meet you down front as we stand and sing.